I'm Beth Golay, and this is Marginalia. Megha Majumdar's new novel, A Guardian and a Thief, was recently shortlisted for the National Book Award, and this isn't her first time being recognized. Her 2020 novel, A Burning, was also longlisted in 2020, and it went on to win the Whiting Award in 2022. Her new novel takes place in Kolkata, India, in a not-so-distant future where food is scarce, travel requires climate visas, and people would do anything to protect their families. I recently spoke with Megha about A Guardian and a Thief, and here's our conversation. So can you give our listeners a description of A Guardian and a Thief? I mean, if you had to describe it in just a few sentences, how would you set it up?
A Guardian and a Thief is a novel which is set in a near future Kolkata, India, which is my hometown. And in this near future, where Kolkata is profoundly affected by climate change, dealing with a food scarcity, two families who are each seeking to protect their own children come into conflict.
So this book is set in the future, but it also feels timely in terms of immigration. In the novel, in order to travel to the United States, Ma, who is one of the main characters, and her family, they have to have climate visas. In your research for the book and in your imagination, does a world that requires climate visas seem so far off?
It really doesn't. It really doesn't. I think migrations, which are not indirectly but directly connected to the effects of climate change, migrations caused by areas of the world becoming very difficult to live in, and realities like extreme heat in cities, realities like needing shade, needing cooling garments, having to think about carrying not only water, but electrolytes when you go out. I think those things are not so far away.
Some of the characters in the book, they would go out at night. They would do their business at night. If somebody was in the sun, I just remember one scene, one sentence where like the tar was melting underfoot. And so that was really a remarkable thing to think about. Let's talk about the title and the exploration of this theme in the book. None of the characters are strictly guardians or thieves. They alternate between the two distinctions repeatedly, and sometimes they're simultaneously thieves and guardians. I'm curious about where this idea, you know, juxtaposing guardians and thieves against each other started for you.
That's a great question. You know, I never wanted to write a book which contained villains or saints. I wanted to write about complex, real people, people who love their children, people who want to protect their families, and they find that that love comes up against their moral centers. I wanted to write people who, in situations of extreme heat, lack of food, climate crisis, they are people who find that love is not so simple. Loving somebody can force them to go places and commit acts which maybe they would not be so proud of. So how do we live with that form of humanity that emerges when our love and our ethics are in conflict?
You know, I did mark a passage in the book which kind of speaks to that. What was absolutely true and right, and what was absolutely false and wrong, and how could any sane person live without crossing the borders every day? Lies were the lifeblood of the world. Lives activated the menacing truth Bumba now understood, and there was only one, which was, take what you want, or others will take it. Talk about this world they're living in.
I'm so glad and touched that that section spoke to you. I was thinking through how we teach children values and principles, and then they grow up and understand that the people who triumph in our world don't necessarily follow those principles. So we have to understand how to constantly navigate this big gap, how to understand that what is good for an individual is not necessarily good for their community, to understand that we might have hope, individual hope for our own children, our own families, and that pushes us to do certain things, but that hope might not be aligned with the hope of our neighbors, our community, the larger society. And it's two forms of love, right? It's love for the people that are so close to you, and it's also a more general and broad love for the people who live in the same city as you, who live in the same neighborhood as you. How do you move between those two kinds of love?
We know from the start that the book is going to evaluate the roles of a guardian and a thief, but I'd like to talk about another role that you just mentioned. It's not explicitly in the title, but that is the role of the child. And, just as the characters are all thieves and guardians, they are all children in some form, which you explore their childhoods, don't you? Can you talk about, looking at the world through the child's lens?
That's a beautiful question. And one really interesting thing about this book is that I was really struggling to figure out the plot until I had my first son. I had him in 2021. And as any parent, anybody taking care of a child knows, the ferocity of love you have for a child is a revelation. And it made me so interested in bringing these children into the book, and also in recalling that the characters who are now guardians in the book were once children, and they possessed that same innocence, and they also have their own journey from that playfulness, that humor, that laughter, to now living in a world where they have to protect that for somebody else.
I want to talk about that innocence for a minute because Dadu dreams of a future Kolkata in which resources are no longer scarce, hunger is sated, the culture is preserved, and perhaps most especially one in which people help each other. Is Dadu unrealistic to wish for this?
Dadu is an optimist. He is in love with this city, which is his hometown. He cannot truly believe that anything bad can happen in this city. He believes in the goodness of the people of this city. He believes that things will change and opportunities will arrive, that neighbors will continue to help one another. And I really wanted to bring that perspective into the book because it points to something true, which is that in a place like Kolkata, and in really any place where you feel that you are in a community, where you care about your neighbors, where you have friends and family nearby, there is this sense of dependence and reliance, right? We reach out to people for help with ordinary things. And I wanted this character to show how that network of dependence, that network of love, is something that gives him so much hope. He believes that from this wreck and ruin, something good will emerge, and it will be because of the people.
Let's talk about the nameless billionaire. She lives in a place called the Hexagon and occasionally offers meals to the poor, but it's almost comical to compare her lavish lifestyle of helicopters and bowling alleys and spas to that of the characters we're getting to know. Can you talk about her for a minute?
Yes, the billionaire character in the novel helped me think about class. I'm very interested in class distinctions. When I was a child, I grew aware of class distinctions very early, and it's something that I think about a lot, is how different groups of people will have different levels of resources to deal with the climate crisis and its effects. And the book, The Billionaire, represents the group of people who will have the most resources and the most freedom in a situation of crisis. And then The main character, Ma, the mother, represents a person from the middle class who is about to emigrate. So a journey to America is possible for her. It gives her a certain level of possibility and capacity, which is unthinkable for the other main character in the book, who is a poor villager. So I hope that these three people help a reader or encourage a reader to think about class. Who will have the ability to escape? Who deserves the ability to escape from crisis and look toward a secure future?
I'd like to talk about the structure of the novel. Ma's sections are broken into segments, lettered segments, A, B, C, D, etc. But Boomba's are not, at least for a while. What is it about Boomba's narrative that didn't fit the structure? Or why did you decide to write the different stories in the different structures?
Such a writerly question. I love it. Part of that is a remnant of how I wrote it. I was focused on writing Ma and her family in the beginning, and the Boomba character, who is a thief, was a secondary character until I realized that the book would not achieve the complexity I wanted unless I allowed Boomba to become a full character in these pages as well. And when we dive into Boomba's story, we are quite deep in Ma's story, and it felt like a good place to offer this invigorating deep dive into a character who, in that kind of rush of narrating his life, I wanted the reader to see, well, there's more to him than you might think.
I was struck by the following quote, and I wonder if you can talk about it a bit, because it does speak a little bit to what you were saying about there being more to Boomba's character. All Boomba was a man whose moral compass pointed toward the north of his own family. Can you speak about that?
One of the most puzzling things for me is how we live in a world where we're often forced to make decisions which are good for us and the people we love, but not good for other people. I'm thinking about agricultural chains, for instance, the people who grow and produce our food and the people who buy them. We might make decisions which are good for us based on price and convenience and nutrition considerations, but that are not good for people who are being exploited somewhere far away in the world, whose families are being harmed by their work conditions. I think that ethical dilemma is ever present in all of our lives because we're all buying things, we're making choices about how we live, what we support, what we champion, and what we reject. And that grim dance of what am I privileging in this moment? Whose well-being do I consider to be most significant? And what kinds of harm am I okay accepting? I think those questions are baffling and huge and so important for us to think about.
So we do learn a little bit of Baba's perspective in America. He is Ma's husband. He is in Michigan. He's a scientist, and he's working on mosquito-borne illnesses, and he is waiting for his wife, daughter, and father-in-law to come to America. But when we see his perspective from his chapter, and not just the phone calls that are happening, but his chapter, he reflects on, the new language or the hurt in being asked, "Where are you really from?" And there was this quote, "The pride of having immigrated was also, in truth, the wound." Can you talk about that?
I drew on my own experience being an immigrant. I moved from India to the US to go to college when I was 19. And in writing this character of the husband who has moved to Michigan and is waiting for his family to join him, I want to write about how there is such a sense of pride and accomplishment in being able to give his family this mode of escape and being able to bring his family over and be certain that his little daughter, who is 2 years old, will have a safe place to live and have plenty of food to eat. That there's also a great deal of sorrow which lies under that sense of accomplishment and pride. And both of those things are true. I think that is one of the most energizing, beautiful things about fiction is that we do not have to accept simple explanations. We can understand that two or more things can be true. I think any immigrants listening to this might know what I mean when I say that migrating, uprooting your life, living somewhere far from home is such a point of pride and accomplishment, yes, but there can also be so much pain because you left behind a person you could have been. You left behind your hometown. You left behind perhaps a mother tongue. You left behind so many people you love. Who would you have been there? That sorrow is true as well.
None of the characters are named exactly, you know, rather they're identified with nicknames. Does this lend a universality to the story? I'm curious about your decision to keep them largely nameless.
Nobody has asked me that yet. Let me think about that. Part of it is just my instinct when I was writing. You know, for anybody who is writing, you know that feeling of something feels right. You try giving a character a name and it doesn't feel right. So that's kind of what happened. I started with Ma, Baba, Dadu, and Mishti, and that's what felt right. And part of it is, I think, pointing toward how much this is a story about family and about the love for family, because in Bengali, these are words for their relationships. You know, Ma is mother, Dadu is grandfather, Baba is father. And the book is so much about the love that you have for your family. What form, what manifestation does that love gain in a terribly difficult time? How does that love change? We think we know that love, but do we really? And that's part of the question of the book.
We are recording this on October 8th, one day after A Guardian and a Thief was shortlisted for the National Book Award. This is your second book and the second time of being a contender for the National Book Award. How are you feeling about all of this?
I feel very surprised and very excited. You know, Beth, I feel very happy. I feel very happy. So many people worked on this book, and the congratulations go to them as well. The brilliant people at my publisher, Knopf, who worked on this book. And at the same time, I feel so delighted. At the same time, I feel aware that awards and things like this are a matter of chance, really. You know, there are so many good books, and these things are a matter of luck and chance.
So, speaking of A Burning, which was your first book, I find myself thinking of that novel often. And I imagine A Guardian and a Thief will take up residence in my mind for many, many years. Do you have a hope for this book, what readers will take away from it?
First of all, I hope that readers feel invited into the book. I love thinking about plot. I love writing something that feels entertaining, which probably sounds a little strange to say, but I think the question of how do you invite a reader into the book and entertain them and keep them turning the pages is very important to me. So I hope that readers have that experience. And then when a reader is done with the book, I hope that they reflect on the question of what do you do when your love for your children obliterates your ethical self? That is the question that I hope a reader stays with.
Well, the book is A Guardian and a Thief. Megha Majumdar, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Beth. This was really special.
A Guardian and a Thief by Megha Majumdar was published by Knopf. Up next, book critic Suzanne Perez looks at a spooky new novel from Rachel Harrison that is part haunted house story, part family dysfunction.
If your October reading leans towards spooky tales, there's a new novel by Rachel Harrison you might want to check out. Harrison has become synonymous with contemporary horror, with previous novels such as So Thirsty, Such Sharp Teeth, and Cackle. So she's covered vampires, werewolves, and witches. And this time, she's turning her attention to the ghosts of childhood trauma. Talk about scary. Play Nice centers on Cleo Barnes, a 20-something stylist and influencer whose picture-perfect exterior hides an ugly past. Cleo and her two older sisters grew up in a haunted house. After their estranged mother, Alexandra, dies unexpectedly, as characters in horror novels so often do, she leaves the house on Edgewood Drive to her three daughters. The two older girls want nothing to do with their childhood home, but Cleo envisions flipping it for profit and a whole lot of online content. The chance to make something pretty, curate an aesthetic, Cleo says. I get to take the setting of the worst time in my family history and transform it into something else, make it unrecognizable. It's the next best thing to burning it to the ground. What Cleo remembers is her parents' messy divorce. Her mother moved Cleo and her sisters into a house occupied by a demon, or so Alex claimed, and the courts later stripped Alex of custody after she went off the deep end. As the home makeover process begins, though, Cleo begins to wonder if there might be some truth to her mother's scary stories. One of the first bits of evidence is a tattered and annotated copy of Alex's book, The Demon of Edgewood Drive, which appears in Cleo's old bedroom. Thus begins the book-within-a-book portion of Play Nice, which Harrison uses to add crucial bits of backstory and other family members' perspectives. How do you prepare your daughter for the world? Alex muses in her book. Do you tell them every ugly truth so that they understand, so that they know what to expect? Or do you fill their heads with dreams and hope for the best? Play Nice is part horror novel, part dysfunctional family drama, part contemporary romance, with a spicy little subplot involving the all-grown-up boy next door. As a main character, Cleo comes off as spoiled and selfish, but also damaged and vulnerable, and she has the courage to face her fears. Harrison's writing exudes slow-burning dread, with just enough creepy scenes to keep the novel moving at a steady pace. And the ultimate climax is surprising and satisfying. For Marginalia, I'm Suzanne Perez.
Play Nice by Rachel Harrison was published by Berkeley. Joining us now to talk books is Janet Geddes, owner of Avid Bookshop in Athens, Georgia. Welcome to Marginalia.
Thank you so much for having me, Beth.
What books would you like to talk about today?
Well, I did want to start with one special book that is a children's picture book that is just such a warm, cozy, sweet read. It's a book by Laurel Snyder, who writes picture books in middle grade that I just love. It's illustrated by Leanne Hatch, and it's called The Book of Candles, Eight Poems for Hanukkah. I actually got to meet this author a couple years before I even opened my bookstore. I met her at a regional conference. And she was at her first bookseller conference and I was at mine, and we ran into each other in an empty hallway, both of us late for the same session. We really hit it off. So it's no surprise that I really love her writing too, since her personality shone so strong to me when I first met her. So having the privilege of being friends with this author who's published many books with major publishers is that once in a while she will show me or read to me from a forthcoming title. So I had the pleasure a few months ago of having her read this book aloud for the first time since it was produced. She read it to me. Laurel's a Jewish author, and I think she saw a need for people, regardless of their heritage or background or religion, just to kind of understand this one aspect of Judaism a little bit more. And the Book of Candles is lovely. It's focused on what the meanings of each night of Hanukkah are, but it's playful and silly. So she takes away, I think, someone like me, I was not raised Jewish. I don't know a lot about it apart from songs that we learned as kids. And so to see this book and see night after night, the kids and the parents trying to figure out a way to honor their Hanukkah tradition, no matter where they are. At one point, they are in a hotel room and realize that I think maybe they got held up and they're in this hotel room instead of home, and they make a menorah out of a banana and they put candles in it. So just the emphasis of that. There are certainly places for nonfiction books for kids, teaching them about particular religions and holidays and ceremonies. But what I like about this is it's just a story of a family. So it's not geared towards any one belief system. It doesn't really matter what you and your family do at home. It's just sweet to see this little crew and how they make things work and how the priority is just finding time together each night of Hanukkah. So it's very, very lovely. And then moving on to adult fiction, this is primarily the category that I read and is by far our store's bestseller here in Athens, Georgia, is just general fiction and literary fiction. A book that I really think should have gotten so much more love, which is not to say it's not beloved, but it's a book I love so much that I wish I had seen it plastered on every cover of every newspaper when it came out. It's called The Correspondent. It's by Virginia Evans. It is such a beautiful story. It's an epistolary novel. And in it, we have a main character who has retired from her career. She lives alone. She thinks of herself as sort of maybe immovable. She strikes the reader as really particular in her ways. She gives the clear impression that she feels that who she is in this moment is who she was always going to be and who she always will be up until the end. And through tracking letters throughout her life to loved ones, to her dearest friend, to her neighbor down the street, you watch this lovely human begin being open to parts of life that she had either slammed the door on herself or felt had been closed off to her. And it's not a story of, say, you know, an elderly person suddenly doing triathlons. It's more subtle than that, but someone who sees their world open and gives it, their relationships a chance to shift and change and grow, even after she thought that was not a possibility. I say that, and that makes the book sound a little bit like a bummer, and it's not at all. It's just beloved, beautiful, well-written book that I just love.
You can find a list of the books Janet mentioned on our website, kmuw.org. Thank you so much for joining us, Janet.
Thank you for having me. Have a wonderful day.
Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita and is part of the NPR network. Our editors and producers for this week's show are Haley Krausen, Luann Stevens, and Carly Cooper. Torin Anderson composed our theme music. This is Marginalia. I'm Beth Golay.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.